Welcome, everybody, to The Rad Life, the only talk radio show that takes you along with host and age explorer Rod Gontos on his continuing journey of discovery into life's challenges, opportunities, options, and all the latest and greatest things that come with getting older. The Rad Life is brought to you this week by Your Home for a Lifetime, a company dedicated to empowering you to stay safely, independently, and comfortably in your own home. And now here is your host, Rad Gontos.
Hey, Paul.
Yes, sir.
You know, when I have to come into the show and do my own technical setup for the cameras and
wow.
stuff.
It's a bad day.
This is a bad day, man. I thought we were getting funding. Did we get cut by the new federal budget? Is that what happened?
I didn't want to tell you that they cut the budget for OC Talk Radio in the new Trump administration here.
Were you under like the Environmental Protection Agency or something? What happened to you?
We were the Endowment for Silliness.
The Endowment for Silliness. The Ministry of Silly Walks got cut. Dang it. For those who, don't realize that our humor is about as old as the topic of interest that we are on the show. That was a little Monty Python flying circus, actually, I believe, not even any of the movies. If you're listening to us live on octalkradio.net, what I'm talking about is we usually feed this on Facebook, and we somehow have technical difficulties.
Little glitch today. We'll
little glitches. And so I'm trying to set up my Facebook feed, and I'll see if we can make that work. So stay tuned and look for us on possibly coming online video feed for you guys. But I
like the time you did it with you and I. That I think it was actually cooler, the handheld camera.
The one where we got 400 views in 48 hours or something. It was like ridiculous.
Well, I'm going to throw out all the fancy equipment and just go with handheld here.
So, well, it's the Blair Witch Project, right?
Oh, another dated reference.
Another dated reference. Is that really dated at this point?
Long time ago that was.
So, in any case, I am thrilled to have in the studio I would call you a friend of the show. Wouldn't you call yourself a friend
Absolutely.
Of the show?
Absolutely.
Yeah, a friend of the show. My buddy, Michael Demeritz, who we will be feeding. Yeah, it might actually work, Paul. We might be able to do this.
There you go.
You have any duct tape for me? I need some duct tape. But we'll probably try to feed this. You can't run away from us.
Mm-mm.
We'll come to you. We will find you. We will give you information, and you will like it.
That's right.
But, Michael, I looked, and I think you were on the first year that we were on the show, somewhere like, I think it was August of 2015.
I liked it when he walked in today, like I'd just seen him last week.
Wow.
And I'm thinking, was he on that recently? And I thought, this guy, he was on a long time ago.
The man never ages. No, I mean,
that's true.
I want whatever he's eating.
I have one of those chambers that I'm sealed in at
night. You are. Creo.
Right. It's an argon gas.
I never age either because I got old early.
This is an inside joke between me and Michael. But, you actually got permitted in that in the city of Tustin?
Yes. I have friends in high places that got me that.
Those fellow friends of ours who know Michael know exactly what we're talking about.
I have high friends in low places.
High friends in low places?
That's another story.
That's pretty much this college, isn't it? So Michael is on the show with us today, and I will have a surprise for everybody a little later on, leading to something that's coming up on the 24th, right?
But stay tuned.
But Michael, last time you were here, and by the way, thank you for your book, Death 101.
Dying 101.
I was dying to read it, and I did read it, and it was pretty good. Uh-huh. And we were just talking before the show opened about how sometimes, I think you could say that about anything in life, right? You could probably say that there are things that we avoid. I haven't started yet. The things that we avoid that sometimes if we actually it's kind of the premise of the show. If we talk about those things, we're a little bit better off, right?
Absolutely.
Doing it earlier, right? And I was sharing that, or you were saying to me, actually, I'll tell you, my wife, when she asks me every Wednesday, she's very sweet. She asks me, like, who's on the show? And I said, well, Michael's on the show. And she goes, Michael. And she didn't remember you for Michael Demeritz, but she remembered, I said, Michael, Lindbergh, Michael Tustin. And she goes, oh, yeah, it's the old house.
Yes.
And so she says,
I have to explain that reference to her because you just said old house and nobody knows.
Why, Michael, why don't you tell people about that? I mean,
my partner and I own the Wilcox Manor, which is an event center in historical property in the city of Tustin. And
beautiful.
It's
beautiful.
And the number one question people always ask is, Michael, where do you live? And I always say, in La Casa. That's where I live. So mm-hmm. I'm in that house. So it's an amazing place.
Mm-hmm. And they're very generous with it. They do a lot of philanthropical stuff.
And you rent it out for events?
We do. We have a permit from the city of Tustin to do 24 weddings per year. Actually, we're doing really well. We're fully booked this year. We were fully booked last year. We've already got a number of bookings for 2018, and it's kind of paying for itself now, which is what we were hoping for. In the last 7 years, 8 years, we've raised $1.5 million for charity. Oh, in addition,
throw out a couple of the charities that you guys do, because I know you have some regulars, right?
The Orange County High School for the Arts, Family Promise of Orange County, mm-hmm. Families Forward, which are both organizations that work with the homeless mm-hmm. situation here in Orange County, the Tustin Historical Society, the Tustin Community Foundation. So a lot of stuff that really impacts people at the local level. We donate auctioned off dinners mm-hmm. In our dining room, and I'm the chef, so I get to show off my culinary expertise.
Wonderful.
And we've made the price for the dinner at auction usually goes anywhere from $3,500 to as much as $15,000.
Wow,
and
wow.
That's 100% donation
good
to
food.
The charity.
You must have some good wine and good food at that dinner.
Oh, yeah. It's a labor of love.
Well, and I'll tell everybody, I mean, if you have an opportunity to happen to be invited or buy a ticket to something to one of these nonprofits that basically
are you trying to suck up
house,
and get invited here?
No, I've been there a number of times. Yeah. Michael would probably let me knock on his door anytime.
I would.
And I haven't been in there in a while, but it is really beautiful. And they're constantly doing stuff. And you can tell it's both their sanctuary and a labor of love. And they share that so openly with the community. And I think that speaks volumes to both of their personalities.
Wonderful.
And in that giving. And at the core of that is sort of now amplified in what Michael has done for how many years now, Michael? 30 some years.
I'm 37 years into end of life care, so
Years into end of life.
Yeah, when I get it right, I'll actually die. but one of the things that I tell people who visit our home for a wedding is that what we do is beginnings and endings,
mm-hmm.
and it's absolutely true. I mean, I find that we do both of those things very well.
Right.
We get to be at the beginning of a life of a couple, and in my work, I get to see people walk out.
Because
the,
you do weddings, and then you also have.
Can I ask you a strange question that has come up once or twice?
Sorry, Paul, before you do, because I did get the feed started. So, hi, everybody, Facebook, Michael Demeretz, where Paul is over there. You can't see
hiding.
Him. Hiding because that's his punishment for not having the technology correct today, right? And we are talking about some tough stuff, which we usually don't avoid on the show, right? So if you have any questions for Michael, ask them. We're going to be talking about suffering. We're talking about end of life. Like, there's not enough bad news, right? But no, but the idea is, and this is really the underlying premise for the show, is that anybody that basically avoids dealing with tough topics, they really are undermining their own ability for independent decision making.
And I also think that they're going to increase the probability of suffering in the future, because if you don't deal with something, it's only going to get worse. The situation that you're avoiding, even having a conversation about, will lead you down a path that maybe not one that you want to go.
Your options will be limited,
yes,
right?
Absolutely.
The key premise here, and I think you could apply this to anything in life, is, and we kind of all know it, except we avoid it in certain areas and topics, understandably, at initial blush. But your independence of decision-making, your ability to feel empowered somehow and to have a little bit more control of what happens to you, basically, right,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
is if you engage in that process earlier, it is not frightening.
Absolutely. I one of the things that happens at these dinners that we do at our house is that it always comes up, well, what do you do?
Mm-hmm.
That's a normal conversation for people to have when they get
together.
How
do you answer that when somebody says, well, what do you do?
I said, I work with dying patients. And automatically,
what's the reaction
it's
do?
Almost like, Oh, wow.
And you even say
that's hard.
And
well, I don't know where to take the conversation now. Yeah. Can I have another drink?
It's exactly. Yeah. I used to.
Oh, look at that time. It's getting late here. Yeah.
I used to use that as an indicator on a plane. When you're on the plane and people talk to you, if you don't want to talk, I usually will say, well, my patients die. And that usually stops the conversation.
You pretty much at that point. Yeah.
They're not interested.
Well, you're seen as the Grim Reaper on a plane now,
right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is that where you're on this plane? But collecting today?
But, you know, whenever we're sitting and talking, people generally want to talk about it. They will say, well, how do you work with them? Mm-hmm. Are you working in hospice? And what is it that you do? And I say, well, you know, I walk down a very difficult path with a patient and their family.
Say the least.
And basically help them navigate a very difficult process, one that we're not prepared for. A lot of times people, and I may come off as kind of a heretic because I really do have some strong opinions about these things, and a lot of times people think it's their physician that's going to help them walk this path, and it's not. Their physician may be aware of some of these things, but their physician doesn't always have the time.
Well, is the physician even prepared to deal with it?
I don't think so.
Do they want to deal with it?
I think that it's easier to deal with aggressive treatment and things that are curative versus saying there's little that we can do
outcome. Yeah, there's exactly to your point. There's a certain aspect of this where you have to almost surrender it, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And I think it's tough for somebody who's basically in a keeping and sustaining of life or saving life to basically be in. It's almost like a counter to
absolutely.
The initial
absolutely.
Program.
I'm going to say it even more bluntly, having watched my mother and father die. They didn't pass away. They didn't go on to a better place. They died.
Yes.
It was a normal occurrence. We can't even use the word anymore.
I know.
Here. Yeah, everybody passes, right? Nobody dies.
Nobody leaves, right? So when my parents
died. There may be some spiritual overtones to that. I mean, there may be just some people's ability.
I think they don't want to have a finality to it. It's too sensitive. Yeah. It might upset everybody. He didn't die. Joe didn't die.
He just passed.
Right?
Yeah.
So.
Like a friggin' envelope you hand somebody.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
we soften it. So when my parents died, I think the doctors view it as a defeat. I mean, they know you're going to die. They know they're not infallible. But they're there to keep you alive. When it's clear they can't do anymore, they really want nothing more to do with you.
So let me ask this, Michael, because you and I have talked about this, and I think we probably agree. And I don't know if I've asked you this last time you were on the show, but a lot of people that are involved in stuff of this nature, okay, this is not just something where you wake up, fill out an application form, and basically say, oh, you know, I think my career counselor basically says I should go into, like, you know, end of life counseling. Right? I think that and I'm not just picking on it, I'm not just specifically talking about end of life counseling, just in general care and providing that counseling and that being that sort of safe harbor for people and whatever their challenges are. That is something that is really, you have to have. I mean, 37 years to do this is not something that you basically were filling in the time getting a paycheck. There's another aspect.
No.
So what made you – walk me through how you got yourself to be involved in this, because 37 years is a long time.
Yeah.
How'd you even discover it?
Well, you know, it's really kind of interesting. I really wanted to be a physician.
Okay.
And
any particular kind, or just general practice?
Oncology. I wanted to go into oncology, and that was certainly something that was of great interest to me. And I had the experience and opportunity to work in one of the first hospice programs in Western Pennsylvania in 1980 as a volunteer. So you get to become very intimate with the dying process if you work in a hospice program.
And so what happened before 80?
I had a lot of experience with end of life with family members. Mm. You had great-grandparents and grandparents pass away
cared for in the
they
family.
They didn't die. They just passed away.
Yeah. But, you know, growing up in the rural part of Pennsylvania and Ohio, you got to
extended
see...
extended family taken care of.
You got to see things like that a little bit more intimately as a young person.
Yeah.
And it wasn't seen as something bad. It was just, this is the
part of life.
Process of life. My grandmother, on my father's side, she died at 63, so she was young. And
don't worry,
Paul. I was 12 or 13 at the time. So, I mean, I was young.
But still aware.
I think that, you know, I'll give you an example that I think that a lot of times nurses that find themselves wanting to work in end-of-life care are nurses who've worked in ICU and have seen people who probably need to pass on and die and can't because there's all these things being done to them that maybe things that they wouldn't want done. Over the years, I've been involved, you know, just kind of helping people access information so that they can make choices and decisions mm-hmm. for themselves in advance. Mm-hmm. So advanced directives and things of that nature start to become more available, mm-hmm. and people could make a decision about whether or not they wanted to be placed on a ventilator.
Wanted to be a doctor because of your connection with things that are life, you know, people going through things yeah. and so forth. But then you ended up not doing that.
Yeah. A very well-known physician in the Pittsburgh area had said to me, he said, Michael, you're going to make a horrible physician. And I said, oh, my God, here I am. This is my life path, and you're telling me that this isn't going to go? It's just crushed. I said, why did you say that? He says, you talk too much. He says, you know, you spend way too much time with the patients that are mine. He says, now, I want you to know, I'm grateful that you do, because you actually find out things that I don't even know about my patients.
But what a reflection on the medical yeah. profession, right?
He says, I don't have time to do this. And mm-hmm. he says, and you clearly do. He says, I think you'd make a great social worker. And so it was social worker, priest. Mm-hmm. It was a choice, you know, and so I decided to go the social work route. And I want you to know, you know, over the years, I've really kind of it's solidified in my mind the reasons why.
Tell me.
I work with in end-of-life care for a very specific reason.
And
that is, generally, whenever I'm called in, I'm not going to mess things up. I'm only going to make things better. Mm-hmm. I'm only going to improve the outcome. Mm-hmm. And even if that person dies, I wasn't getting involved to save them. Mm-hmm. I was getting involved to make things better.
Mm-hmm. For them and the people around them.
And today, I do that on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. I want you to know that I work in an awesome program, an awesome hospice program, and literally at the end of every day, I feel like I've accomplished really great things mm-hmm. for that particular patient and family, because I've made that difference happen for them.
So let's give us some background on the whole hospice idea, where it came from. It hasn't been around that long here in America. It's a fairly new idea. And the reason I know that is because my late mother, for a variety of other reasons like you're talking about, started volunteering and became very passionate about it, worked very deeply in it in Michigan in the 70s and 80s. When it was just kind of catching hold here. She volunteered.
Yeah.
They actually had separate hospice facilities yeah. where people would go to yeah. die. And yeah. She was a volunteer there and then ended up studying yeah. and working with people and everything.
Do you know, the very first hospice program in the United States began in 1974 in Connecticut.
See, I knew it was around that time. Yeah,
and
exactly.
1974 in Connecticut, a gentleman who I actually worked with and worked for, Dennis Resendez. He was the founder of that program. And interestingly enough, he died last year, but long life, and did some amazing things. And I had the pleasure of working with him for a number of years in the early 90s.
So what is hospice?
Hospice is an absolutely awesome program. And I want you to know, it's really about quality of life than about end of life. Mm-hmm. It's about making this final chapter the best possible for the patient and the family. Orchestrating a good death is something that we have the ability to do, but frequently we get involved in hospice too late. That is the number one response that families have after the death, and that is, I wish I knew about you sooner.
Interesting.
Number one.
So what triggers hospice? I mean, let's start with that.
Well, usually it's triggered by the fact that nothing more can be done.
And so who decides that?
Frequently it's the physician. Uh-huh. Sometimes it's the patient saying enough. Sometimes it's the family saying, you know, we're done. This is too much. What else is left? A lot of times people think that hospice is only for the very end, and so they wait until it's, you know, just really that crisis.
So it sounds to me like there's a misunderstanding mm-hmm. of what hospice is. There is a certain avoidance, understandably, because it's nothing that you really necessarily want to deal with. But it's also probably because it's not clear that it actually provides you a little bit more control and quality of life. Mm-hmm. And so how, other than the physician basically telling you you need hospice, how do people even find out about this?
Well, everybody knows what hospice is. Even people who don't speak English know what hospice means. It means you're going to die.
Right.
And so people avoid the word. Uh-huh. Sometimes we will even get involved with patients, and the family will say, don't mention the word hospice. And
so there's a serious denial going on.
Very much so. And that happens daily, and people not wanting to even use the language. And again, as I said, some people, even people who don't speak English, know what that means. It's kind of like they know what the word cancer means. It's not a good word as far as they're concerned. Hospice is even worse because it means that you're giving up. You're giving up hope. I happen to believe that you can be hopeful and be on hospice. You can have hope for pain-free days. You can have hope for closure with families and friends and being able to say the I love yous and please forgive me and things of that nature.
What kind of time – I mean, I hate to put it in terms of time frame, but on average, how – what kind of time, once that physician basically says, you know, you got to, you should be considering hospice, how much time does that family or that person have?
Typically, in the United States right now, it's a couple of weeks. It could be as short as a few days. The benefit itself is an unlimited benefit, but typically a physician is asked to certify that the person is considered terminal, meaning that they have 6 months or less remaining in their life, and that under the normal trajectory of their disease process that they would die within 6 months. I go further and say, would you be surprised if this person died within the next 6 months? Because sometimes physicians may be hesitant to say, I'm not, you know, I can't predict the future, la, la, la.
I don't want to be the one making the call.
And so I'm frequently wrong. And so I can't tell you when this person's going to die, even though that I, as a social worker working in hospice and end of life care for as long as I have, I know when someone's got days. I can see it. I can. I've been around this a long time. I know what it looks like, and I know what it feels like.
In fact, in the facility my mother volunteered at in suburban Detroit, again, this was a separate home. I know they don't do that out here in California like they did back there, where they take you somewhere and give you this comfort and care and try and facilitate your final chapter here, make it as comfortable and easy as they can, and to help you hold your hand and help you through. People are terrified. They actually had a red light outside the room, and when the red light was on, that told people walking through that that person was, in the staff's opinion, actively dying.
That's really the end. So let me ask this, just again, for those who are joining us on Facebook right now on the live feed, Michael Demeritz, who's a friend of the show's and a friend of mine, and we're talking about end of life. We're talking about suffering. We're talking about hospice at this moment. And Paul, that you just heard, basically is outside of camera range, but he's part of this conversation. And if you have any questions, because this is a tough topic, so usually you don't get opportunities to basically ask questions about this. Okay, this is a safe place today. If you guys have any questions, ask. We'll be on the air for another about half an hour or so. And
they can call in, too.
Call in. What's the number, Paul?
949-330-7761. 949-330-7761. Operators standing by.
And we'll take your questions, or you can actually just type them on, and we will ask.
So can I go back to the question I was going to ask earlier?
What I was going to ask is, what you guys are talking about is, and we're talking this just for a minute about the time duration, right? What drives the fact that it's 2 weeks? Could it be diagnosed, I guess is the word, earlier?
Oh, absolutely. I think that what happens is that people are doing rescue kind of maneuvers at the very end and staving off what is coming.
Because if you know somebody's terminal for six months, why two weeks before?
Well, and organs start shutting down and other things start happening.
What happens is it becomes a crisis where nothing more, and they'll even use the words, nothing more can be done to a family or to a patient. Nothing more can be done. At the time that nothing more can be done is stated, is different based upon your age. So if you're younger, they don't say that until the very, very last moment. Nothing more can be done.
Right.
If you're a child, they never say it. They never say it.
But if you're 90...
If you're 95 or 100 years old, they may say it a little sooner, but still, you're still going to die quickly.
But they don't... When you say if you're a child, they don't say it. They don't say it to you? Or do they say it to the parent? Or they just don't say it?
They just don't say it. They never give up. And I don't have children, but I know
I understand that
parents really struggle with when do they stop pursuing aggressive treatment.
Right.
I don't work with children right now. Right. I mean, right. I have in the past, so things may have changed.
It's a different.
But I do know that there's something called open access, mm-hmm. and we do open access hospice with children where they can continue to pursue aggressive treatment at the same time having hospice services. It's something that I think is actually a really pretty good option mm-hmm. for them. You know, we should be thinking about good pain management and symptom management for children who are facing end of life.
While you're still in that particular case, having sort of a hopefulness.
Yeah, you know, we can't. One of the things that's troublesome for many people to make the decision to go on to hospice is you have to stop pursuing aggressive treatment,
exactly.
And meaning that you have to stop paying for it.
Mm-hmm. And that, let me stop you for a second, because my aunt, who's 92, we talk about in the show, she's not actively dying, but she does have a disease, a form of cancer that will eventually take her life. And we were at her oncologist a couple months ago and trying to get him to say, you know, how much time? What are we looking at? Years, days, you know, whatever. Of course, he says, I don't know, and all that stuff. Wouldn't come up with any even estimate. So she asked about hospice. She wrote it up. And he looked at her and he kind of winced and he said, well, you know, when you go on hospice, I can't see you anymore. And she says, what? And she says, no, that's, you know, once you're on hospice, if you're officially qualified for hospice care, and I don't know what the terms are under Medicare or whatever you can qualify for, but the idea is that you stop treatment. Is that correct?
Is that correct,
yeah.
Michael?
Yeah, absolutely. But it doesn't mean that you stop caring. Mm-hmm. And the care that a person receives, certainly different diagnoses have different trajectories, but if you have end-stage cardiac disease, you still have time. We can manage your symptoms actually better on hospice than if you weren't. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, there's all sorts of really neat things that are coming down the pike. But, I mean, once you've reached a certain point, you're at end of life. And there's not much more that we can do to change that outcome.
So who pays for this quality, this extra care that comes in?
Before we talk about the cost, let's just talk about, so you've been just kind of follow projection here. The doctor basically calls it and makes a decision and, you know, you should be considering hospice. Now what happens?
Well, they usually will say, well, I can have someone come in and speak to you about hospice,
okay.
And that they can tell you what that looks like, who pays for it, what services are available, where that occurs, things of that
and
nature.
And is that when you come in?
Sometimes. I mean, I will do presentation of benefits and things like that. I frequently will be called in as a consultant in my private practice to do exactly that, to kind of give people the lay of the land mm-hmm. where they can ask questions where they don't feel like they're making a commitment to anything. Mm-hmm. And I will tell people, I'm going to tell you everything. These are all the things that are available to you at this point in time. You can continue to pursue aggressive treatment up until the end. Mm-hmm. And in most circumstances, the insurance or Medicare, whoever's paying, will continue to pay the bill. Nobody's going to say, you must go on hospice. There may be people who say, gosh, I think you really should consider it. But the reality is that in this country, we're not forcing people to go on hospice.
And is the decision to go on hospice, the driving reason kind of at that point, is because of trying to maintain the caliber and quality of life at that point?
I don't know.
How do people make that decision?
Frankly, it's throwing a life preserver to someone who's already drowning. You know, at that point in time where we really are dealing with a crisis situation, it frustrates me because we could have done so much more days or weeks prior to now going out and really being just crisis intervention. You know,
because it only starts when somebody says, there's nothing else I can do.
Now,
you're done.
You know, you're throwing a life preserver to somebody who's already drowning.
Yeah. And, you know, we manage. And I know lots of hospice programs. There's more than a couple of dozen in Orange County. I know lots of people who work in hospice care, and we're all doing the same thing. You know, we're getting people 24, 48 hours before they die. That's horrible. Mm-hmm. That's absolutely horrible.
So what is it you do?
Well, hold on. You asked a question about cost.
Yeah, so what is it you do about the cost?
Let's just cross that off the bridge. So who pays for hospice?
And what is it that you get?
If you're Medicare eligible, Medicare pays hospice 100%. Anything that's related to the terminal diagnosis is going to be covered 100%. There's no co-pays, no co-insurance, no nothing you're going to have to come up with. Now, there are things that they won't pay for, like a caregiver. Mm-hmm. You're going to have to pay for a caregiver or have a family member. They're not going to pay for the facility unless you're going in for respite for 5 days. But the reality is that if you can go home with family, they will provide everything that you need.
And what is it that you get?
Equipment, hospital bed, commode chair, over-the-bed table, oxygen concentrator. refrigerators, you know, whatever it is that is going to make it more comfortable for you to be at home, they'll provide.
Okay, so you said that everybody is pretty much doing the same thing, and you're getting that call, you know, for 24 to 48 hours, and you're very frustrated.
Oh, it's horribly frustrating.
So what in your ideal scenario, if there's such a thing when relevant to this topic per se, what would you like to see happen?
Well, one of the things that I said I write a blog on LinkedIn, and one of the things that I said is with respect to palliative care, is that we shouldn't be asking people if they want palliative care. It's kind of like asking people, would you like oxygen? You know, then I go, I really work it out. And I said, well, you know, if you like oxygen, we'll have somebody come out and talk to you about oxygen and see if you'd like to sign up.
Let me tell you all about oxygen. Yeah. See if you want to sign up for oxygen.
And then arrange for oxygen later, you know, after you've decided about oxygen. But the reality is that I think that palliative care should be provided to anyone who has a serious illness. Now, the reason I'm using the word palliative care and not hospice is because I believe that we should begin to talk about what good medical care looks like. Mm-hmm. And good medical care isn't always being in the ICU on a ventilator. Mm-hmm. That's not necessarily what most people want. If you tell people, oh, would you like to have a – hey, Rod, you want to have a ventilator? And asking you
not particularly, but right now, you
say no.
Yeah.
But if you're gasping for breath,
oh, give me whatever I can.
You
get.
Will take a ventilator.
Yeah, absolutely.
So asking someone who comes into the emergency room in the hospital, "Would you like a ventilator?" Or actually, I can put a tube down your throat and it'll actually stop this uncomfortable feeling of not being able to breathe. Would you like that? Sometimes patients and families say, do whatever you have to do. Mm-hmm. Do everything. And that's sometimes we have to ask a family, what does that mean to you, to do everything?
So take a minute and actually talk about what is palliative care?
Palliative care, a lot of times people will hear the word palliative care and say, oh, they'll even ask their physician. And the physician will say something, well, it's like hospice, or it's hospice light, or it's the time right before hospice, or it's just like hospice. And they'll use the word hospice in some part of the conversation, and that will immediately attach that word to something undesirable. The truth and the reality is that hospice is a form of palliative care.
Okay.
It is the end stage version of palliative care.
Okay.
In reality, you can receive palliative care at diagnosis. If you have pain and other symptoms that are out of control, it is very valuable for you to engage a palliative medicine specialist.
So at time of diagnosis,
yes.
at what? Like if you're diagnosed?
You have a serious illness.
You're just diagnosed with a serious illness.
You have a serious illness and you're symptomatic. So somebody that's symptomatic, meaning they're already having some difficulty breathing, they may be very anxious, they may have problems with
walking or balance or other sorts of things.
Well, more symptoms, you know, pain out of control, not being able to breathe, being very anxious, things like that. Those are patients who may not necessarily be close to death, but they could benefit from seeing a palliative medicine specialist.
So you're talking potentially years.
Potentially years prior, exactly.
And what do you get at that stage?
If you're receiving palliative care, you're most likely going to be seeing a physician or nurse practitioner who's going to be assessing on a regular basis your need for other services as needed. Kind of like, you know what? It's sometimes very difficult for some physicians to be prescribing opiates or other medications that are for anxiety, for depression, things like that. They may not be well experienced in that. A palliative medicine specialist is going to have the experience of doing that.
And does that take place?
It's all done on an outpatient basis.
Exactly. So it's an outpatient basis. Is it available, readily available?
Pretty much. You can demand to see a palliative medicine specialist in most hospitals in California.
So do you find that transition happens? Is it recommended at that early stage or not? And if you're grinning at me, why?
Well,
doesn't it?
Money.
Well, one, there is very poor reimbursement at this point in time for palliative care. Mm-hmm. There are some insurance companies who recognize, if we do this, this may get us in earlier to begin to have the conversation about hospice. And part of my concern is that we're still closely associating hospice and palliative care, almost like they're interchangeable.
But like you said, palliative care, hospice is really the end stage of palliative care.
Correct.
And just to repeat to people, palliative care could be years.
It could be.
It's from the time of diagnosis.
It could be at the time of diagnosis.
If
if the person is symptomatic.
So again, being informed and educated in this allows you to then basically demand what you have.
And the term palliative means like comforting.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
And, you know, I can tell you, I have friends who I care very deeply about, who I have suggested, you know what, I think you need to see a palliative medicine specialist. And almost immediately they'll say, I'm not dying.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll say, well, gosh, I didn't say that you were dying.
Mm-hmm.
I hear what you're saying, and what you're sharing with me says, I'm in pain. I'm having some level of discomfort. There's things that are going on that mm-hmm. I think would be beneficial to be seeing a palliative medicine specialist.
So my aunt is 92. She's had a rare form of blood cancer called Waldenstrom's that prevents the production of red blood cells. And 20 years ago, almost to the day, she was diagnosed and given 5 years to live, which is why she moved out here to be with my mom. Only along the way, my mom died and left her alone. She has no family other than me. She never got married or any kids or anything. And so for 20 years now, she's been suffering alone, goes to see an oncologist on a regular basis. They used to give her Procrit shots to produce red blood cells. That doesn't work so much anymore. She's constantly anemic, weak. She falls a lot, all those kinds of things, lives alone, overweight, scared, all the things you can imagine. And it wasn't until she was forced by her old employer off of, they dropped her Blue Cross coverage after 30 years and said, sorry, that promise we made to you is not valid anymore. We're not going to cover you as a retiree. You just live too long, cost us too much. And they didn't put it that way, but that's what it did. And instead put her on a Medicare Advantage. They arranged to get her on a Medicare Advantage plan that they help supplement. And that's an HMO. So now the first time she goes, she can't go see her old oncologist anymore. She goes to see starting this year, a new HMO. And one of the benefits of the HMO is they said, we offer palliative care. And we can't believe you've never been approached about this for 20 years. So she's not sure what to expect, but the nurses are coming out to see her this week and evaluate her. And what kinds of things could they do for her?
Now, you've been dealing with your aunt for a long time. How long have you been dealing with your aunt?
Well, she moved out here.
As a caregiver, basically.
My parents helped, kind of took the front line when she first moved out. And then they died each one at a time over a period of time. My dad died last three years ago. My mother died about 10 years ago. And during that period of time, it's been more and more. I'm an only child, and I'm the only relative she's got left. So it's fallen to me more and more exclusively since my dad died.
So how does it make you feel that you're now addressing this? Because the joke was that we always talk about is when you go see your aunt, you're basically, your outing is to go look at assisted living.
Yeah, that's what we do for fun.
And she won't go to assisted living.
Right, exactly.
So how does that, I mean, you've been around with her all this time.
Oh, yes.
It is now, it's like they're going out to, how does that make you feel, Paul? I mean, that's...
It's frustrating. It's constantly frustrating because we all want an answer. It all goes to the core issue of this final stage is that, one, nobody wants to deal with it until you have to. Certainly not the patient and certainly not the people around. Two, when you do, you're constantly in denial. Something good's going to happen. Come on, we're going to find an answer. We're going to find a cure. We're going to find something better. Something's good going to happen
here.
And three, thing that comes about is frustration because it's kind of an endless curve. It's a never-ending struggle. And after a while, you just want to sort of put it out of your mind. And that's why I think assisted living, all those things. Okay, good. She's somewhere taken care of. Off my chart. I can worry about something else here. She's good.
Well, so again, I think. Sorry if you're watching us on Facebook with the live feed. We are having a little bit of technical problems. So I don't know what it is. Is Mercury in retrograde? Maybe
something weird going on.
I think there's a full moon too.
There's a full moon too in the middle of the afternoon.
And we're talking about death and dying, and everybody's trying to turn it off. They don't want to hear this.
You know, I really need you to work on our sound and music. You know, and sound effects on this show.
Some somber
something. You know.
Grim Reaper-ish.
But
so you asked a question. It's a very...
Well, because you've been involved very personally with your aunt for a very long time.
Well, before that, my mother and dad.
And she's been
too,
very independent, doesn't want to do with anything, right?
Right.
And now all of a sudden, it's becoming real.
Oh, yeah. It's been real for a while.
Well, but not to her, necessarily, right? I mean, she's dealing with it, but...
Well, she would never have requested palliative care. She's still not sure she wants it. She's still not sure what it's going to do. That's why I'm kind of wondering what she should expect. They offered it to her because of this HMO program. Their theory is it helps save cost in the long run.
I know why they've offered it.
Why have they offered it?
Because it makes absolutely perfect sense to the HMO from the standpoint of, you know what, let's get somebody who's knowledgeable about the next chapter to be at least... available to the client to begin to have those conversations. They're just conversations.
Yeah.
The thing that makes me crazy is the number of people who don't want me to talk. People don't usually say that to me directly. I just know by their
kind of
action.
Kind of funny.
They like stop looking at me. They don't show up for appointments. You know, there's some avoidance that goes on. And I'm just saying, this is a conversation. Mm-hmm. You can choose to accept it or not. You don't have to take in what I've told
just
you.
Just because you expose yourself to the information.
So again, I'm trying to get a real, having never been through palliative with either my mom or dad. You know, she's doing that. And she did cancel the appointment twice. I'll make note already here.
I think that she should see the person. And the reason that she should see the person is because this is someone who's going to give her the lay of the land, the lay of the future horizon. And that's going to be valuable to her because, you know, she has a condition that she could continue to treat. I don't see a reason why she should stop treating unless she's miserable. It doesn't sound like she's miserable. It sounds like she just needs
help. Well, actually, I'll back up. The doctor did say there is nothing we can do to treat anymore. The only way to produce red blood cells is these shots, and the shots weren't doing anymore. So all she's doing now is getting monthly
transfusions.
Okay. which invigorate her for a while, and then it wears off and invigorates her for a while, and we're kind of this last step. She can't get chemo. They tried that. She's too old to try and attack the underlying cancer.
Yeah.
They can't do anything anymore to produce red blood cells for her.
Okay. So she's presented the information. She's alert. She's oriented. She makes her own
decisions.
Very
much so, yeah.
She should be able to make the decision when to stop. She can continue to make an informed decision up until she no longer can.
So I'll tell you what will be interesting for me, Paul, because I know from what you've shared about your aunt is that she's very independent.
Very.
Right? And absolutely, like, you know, like we were saying, the joke was, you know, every time you go out there, your outing is to go look at assisted living so that she can tell you, no, I'm not ready.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? So it will be interesting for me to see how being exposed to the information from palliative care, how she, as an independent woman that has always been, you know, ferociously independent, will then process that information, and whether out of being exposed to that, she actually, again, is reinforcing her independence and feels empowered to make decisions. Because that's exactly the point I think Michael is saying, you've been talking about, is that getting into that palliative situation, managing it, feel that actually gives you empowerment. And what's happening is when it gets misconstrued as hospice, it's kind of a desperate last minute thing.
Yeah.
And it's sad.
What's sad really is really the fact that when people go on hospice, typically in the United States, they die quickly. So it reinforces the belief that you go on hospice and you die quickly.
Right.
And they will even say, oh my God, grandma went on hospice and they started her on morphine and she died quickly.
Yeah.
Now the reality is she needed morphine or she needed what the staff did, but she was so close to end of life that that's what happened. She died quickly. And so people, when they hear they're being referred to hospice, they're automatically assuming I'm going to die quickly if I go on hospice. So if I choose something else, and frequently today they will offer palliative care because they can't offer hospice because people have just refused it.
There's such a pushback.
They need it.
Right.
But there's a pushback. Okay, I'll have palliative care because it still allows me the out.
But are we diagnosing still in the same way that we were diagnosing before as far as time? Hospice, but we're now basically just packaging it as palliative care so that people can accept it.
I mean, there are my colleagues in the community that would disagree with me, but the reality is it's the same thing. It's just another way of saying
the way that it's being presented.
It's just another way to say you're dying.
Well, and I'll share. Yeah. Chrissy Ann basically just piped in on Facebook. Hi, Chrissy Ann. She said that palliative care increases the quality of life, no matter the amount of time left.
Absolutely.
And I think you're saying exactly the same thing.
I absolutely agree. We need to be further
upstream. So is it cost? Is it? I mean, why isn't it offered earlier? I would think that...
All this is money.
Well, hold on. You're just a crabby baby boomer over there.
But I got to stop you guys because every doctor that I've talked to, from my mom, my dad, everything... put them in assisted living, put them in this, put them in that, and then you go find out it's costly. There's a cost to this. You don't get – now, hospice is different. Once you get qualified, then it's covered. But so many programs and things, everybody so quickly says, my aunt has no money. She's broke. She has no money. She doesn't have a house. She doesn't have anything. And everybody just shrugs their shoulders and says, well, then I don't know what to do.
Okay, so, Michael, do you agree with that?
Yes.
Okay. So it is, money.
I think money is certainly an aspect of it. I think that we're doing what we can in the community to address it. It's going to take some time. It's going to take some governmental action in terms of making a benefit that looks similar to hospice that could be used similarly. And I, you know, my personal opinion, not based upon who I work for or anything.
My personal opinion is that the
government will look at the hospice benefit and modify it in some fashion so that people can access it earlier, something called palliative care, that they can be paid, you know, similarly in some fashion, because we don't really fully take advantage of the hospice benefit. If the patient comes onto service and dies the next day, we've not really provided them hospice. We've provided them crisis intervention from knowledgeable people.
Right.
You know, palliative care, I think, is phenomenal.
Well, and I would think that that would be a very natural thing for us to do as a country, especially when the realities of the demographics that we're dealing with is the way they are. I mean, you have people that are older, that are staying old or aging longer, right? That to the points that we were talking about would be maybe diagnosed at a certain point and are looking at a longer period of time before they actually get into
but
that.
But did you look at the new health bill that's been passed the House? It's the opposite. It benefits young people by giving them more choices of coverage. They can get a skinny coverage. They can get no coverage. They can get coverage under a plan that doesn't force, that doesn't cover pre-existing conditions. So they're going to benefit. But the older, which is why ARP and others have opposed this plan, it allows them to raise the cap that previously was three times the base rate to five times
but
the
you
base
know what
rate.
I, but
it's going to increase
but regardless of sort of the political side of this argument, I think we as a nation, and I think as people in general, I don't know if it's even limited to the United States, right? We have this denial about this aging factor.
Well, sure. No,
it's not just a river in Egypt.
No. It's not. It's absolutely not.
Denial.
Again, our jokes are as good as old as the subject matters that we deal with, right? But see, you slid that by me so quickly.
I'm going up denial.
This is not my first rodeo.
It's not your first rodeo. But really, I mean, the numbers are going to – we're going to face a crisis because it's unavoidable, okay? You got 80 million people that basically are aging and where they're staying older longer, if that even makes sense. Whereas your parents may have passed away in their 70s, now it's not unusual to say somebody's 100.
Right.
Right? And if you're going to get diagnosed because the way the medical system is, you may be diagnosed and the lifestyles that you've led before, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
You may, you know, hash bashes that basically Paul was in the University of Michigan.
No, I deny that.
We're going to face these realities, and how long do we keep our head in the sand on this?
Here's the other reality. I got to say this, and I know that nobody wants to hear money, 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 but
Paul.
This is the crux of the whole thing. It isn't just that we're in denial, and if we wake up, we'll do something about it. Who's going to pay for it? Employers don't want to pay for it. The government doesn't want to pay for it. And individuals can't pay for it.
So that's the question.
The government will pay for it.
Okay.
The government will pay for it. And I think that there's a lot of cost savings that come as a result of providing.
Bingo.
I agree.
Cost savings that come as a result of doing. And I want you to know, I educate people all the time on what good medical care looks like.
Right.
Good medical care is not necessarily what you think. Good medical care is actually cheaper.
Expand on that.
You know, sometimes people think, oh, I want to be able to go in the ICU and have all this equipment and dialysis and everything else. But the reality is the good medical care might be a nurse coming to see you on a regular basis in your home, a physician who does a regular evaluation of what's going on with your situation.
Keeping you out of the hospital. Right.
I mean, we have, you know, we don't have a whole lot of time.
It's all right.
But there's something that I'm going to put this out on the table and we'll come back and talk about it another time.
Well, before you go, let me just clear. Do we have time after this, after the 1 o'clock gong today?
A little bit. I got a 1:30.
Okay, so we got a little time.
Okay. What I want to say is the baby boomers are not going to go gently into that good night.
No.
One of the things.
If anybody's thinking
they're not going to go easy. It's going to be difficult. I look at what I do today as job security. I'm going to be able to do this as long as I'm alive and capable of doing it. But I want you to know the issue of control is gigantic for the baby boomer population. And one of the things that gives them the greatest access to control the situation is the End of Life Option Act.
Huh.
Making the decision to end your life at a time of your own choosing is something that we're going to have to deal with. Now, we have it passed as law in the state of California. That was done last year.
Yeah.
We don't even know what that's going to look like mm-hmm. in the coming months and years.
But isn't that just assisted suicide?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Now, I'm not saying that anybody is suggesting that. I don't bring it up whenever I talk to patients. If patients ask me about it, I will have a conversation.
But it
is going to be the issue that the baby boomers are going to talk about.
But it's interesting.
They talk about it now.
But it's interesting, too, Michael, that it wasn't that long ago that if you said the words assisted suicide, you were almost crossing the line into penalized, illegal, yeah. right? Now we are sort of talking yeah. about it, but we have relabeled it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they've even, you know, the law as it was passed, it changes on the death certificate what you died from. You did mm-hmm. not die from suicide because mm-hmm. they made that specifically as part of the law so that it would not affect your ability to collect life insurance.
Well, also doesn't offend you on the spiritual level if you happen to be religious.
So they've had facilitated death, and you know, are we in a way
in California sort of in the forefront of this? Or,
well, I
or
think
is it pretty
Oregon there, and some of
well,
the other places.
Yeah. We're not new at this, but we are the biggest state in the U.S. to do it. And that was the reason why the organization that pushed it in California chose California. They've mm. moved on to other territories.
So walk us through what that means. Can you just decide at any time I'm going to end my life?
No.
You have to be diagnosed with a terminal disease. You have to have two physicians that say that you are terminal and that you are of sound mind and you're making this decision freely. And you have to do it over a period of time.
Which, again, making this decision freely means that do you get to make this decision in advance?
Well, no.
What if you're incapacitated?
No. They also made it very difficult for someone with like Alzheimer's or dementia. You have to be diagnosed with a terminal disease, meaning 6 months or less.
Yeah.
Someone who is 6 months away from death as an Alzheimer's or a dementia patient.
You don't have that option?
You don't have that option
right.
because the trajectory is much longer. You've got 6-10 years of time, and the 6 month end of life period for an Alzheimer's patient, you're not capable of making these decisions. So it automatically excludes people who are demented.
So what in the perfect world of Michael does this look like?
Oh, God.
Oh, come on. You've had 30-plus years to think about this.
We're going
to
hand you
I didn't hand you this question.
Man, I can get into a lot of trouble here. Let's
see. We're going to hand you the magic wand. We're going to hand you the power stick.
I want you to know.
I've had a dome of silence right here. I have had a lot of another dated reference.
I'm a good Catholic boy. And I was in opposition to the passage of this law. But I want you to know what we're facing is something that I do believe will happen. Do you remember the movie Soylent Green?
Yes, of course. Charlton
Heston. There's a segment of that movie that I believe is prophetic, and it's called Going Home. Mm-hmm. The elderly gentleman that goes into the building,
Edward G. Robinson,
it's called Home, mm-hmm. and you go into this room, and they project whatever you want on the screen surrounding you as they give you whatever lethal injection, and it takes maybe 10 or 15 minutes to die. You get wonderful music and blah, blah, right. blah. All it's wonderful. And I think that that's something that we're going to see.
A final crescendo.
I think that because I want you to know, I can't reveal my sources, but I want you to know I have a very good friend who actually has seen the numbers and what we're looking at in terms of people choosing to exercise the End of Life Option Act.
What are the numbers
almost,
like?
It's high. We haven't been at it a year, and we've already got some places that are saying, you know, about 100 people have chosen to go that. This is a new law. Now I want you to know
is this wacky left coast mindset, people?
Not at all. These are people who literally have made the decision, you know what? It's about control. I'm going to give this person control over this process. We now have the legal ability to do that. And my concern is that we actually have a decent conversation about why. And that's why I wanted to talk about suffering, because I think that people who are suffering make this decision more easily than people who are not suffering.
And it brings us back full circle.
Correct. So if I address your suffering in a way that solves the problem for you,
then do you still make that decision?
You don't. You want to have access, but you don't make, I'm going to cry because I want you to know this is something that people need to have this conversation with someone who's sensitive enough mm-hmm. to have the conversation mm-hmm. and listen to the pain that this person is going through. Mm-hmm. People who are suffering on many levels. It's not just physical pain.
Right.
It is emotional. It's spiritual. It's psychological. Yeah. We have got to spend more time with people dealing with this issue because we're going to have people killing themselves without having the knowledge that they could have this solved. The problem can be solved.
Mm-hmm. So having it as an option maybe gives you a sense of independent decision making. But what you're saying is you're under a false pretense of or a false feeling that you have no ability to manage your suffering. Because you haven't been given the opportunity to actually get
nobody's
that kind
addressing
of
it. Nobody is addressing
right.
it.
And your you have physician, no hope. Right.
Your physician may ask you a question. Nurses may ask you a question. What is your pain level? They don't ask you,
and
are you having a
and
spiritual
crisis? And we talked about that. They're not prepared to have that conversation.
Are you having a spiritual crisis?
Right.
No.
Right.
Are you concerned about what's going to happen to you after you die?
Or right. your family.
They don't have those conversations because they're not equipped.
Or they avoid them like
Or they
anything.
Avoid them.
Right.
Can I give you another
example? So who is it that is supposed to have that conversation with them?
Not
Me.
The doctor.
There's only one, Michael.
A chaplain, social worker, nurse practitioner.
Are chaplains prepared to have
Absolutely.
That conversation?
Someone who's a clinically trained chaplain in a hospital environment, they can have this conversation. And I think they do. I think we have these conversations. We try to get people ahead of time.
So who has that conversation with somebody, for example, who maybe is not religious? Is it a social
Me.
Worker?
Social workers.
Uh-huh.
People who are trained in this area, someone who's a nurse practitioner, someone who is trained in palliative care mm-hmm. can have this conversation.
That's really heavy because yes, we have the legal ability to basically allow people to do that. But again, if you realize that you have an option in managing your suffering and going back to palliative care where you basically, from time of diagnosis, are basically given the benefit of doing that. Now, to Paul's point, the cost, because we're saying, okay, get ahead of it. Provide people the opportunity to do that.
Oh, I can answer the question you're going
yeah.
for right now.
Go
is
ahead.
Is suffering can be treated successfully.
Okay.
And it's covered.
Who covers it?
Medicare, private insurance. Everybody covers the treatment of suffering. Now let's break it down. If you have
is it just how you define it?
It is.
That makes it whether it's covered or not?
Well, no. I think the thing is that you need to ask for it. For example, someone who has pain out of control needs to be managed with heavier drugs.
Mm-hmm. But psychological suffering isn't covered. If you're in grief, if you're worried about what's going to happen to your family,
I think we need to take personal responsibility for seeking that out. And that is something that you can pay for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
You can access that through your own people. You put it out online. Help me. I am suffering XYZ. People will reach back to you.
Well, right. And any of us who have actually at some point or the other sought some kind of counseling assistance mm-hmm. in our life knows that if you get in ahead of it, you don't just do that and you get the benefit of it right there and then. You actually carry the benefits with you sort of the next time you are challenged in some way or the other. So that to your point about the psychological and the emotional suffering, if you have the tools already in you, that helps. You can help manage
so
it a little bit
back and,
or seek it out for additional assistance.
Right.
It's not this fearful thing to do.
Let me make this point again.
Go ahead.
I've seen this now too many times. What you're expecting, I think, Rod, is a nice orderly process. A doctor says, we've tried everything we can. I've used up all my bag of tricks. There is nothing left to do. And doctors will at some point tell you that. But what the doctor tells you at that point, happened to my aunt's best friend last year, is don't come and see me anymore. We're done. I can't help you anymore. Goodbye. Do not come into my office ever again.
I am not looking for an orderly manner. In fact,
okay.
Let me finish this.
So imagine you just got a diagnosis that there's nothing left to be done. You're dying. And then you say, what next? And the doctor shrugs and says, hands you some brochures or something and says, your time's up. You have to leave. There is no transition to the Michaels of the world. They don't seamlessly say, hey, you know, I knew this conversation was going to be tough and Michael's waiting outside and he's ready to talk to you or the chaplain is or the social worker.
Should we turn it on him? I'll turn it on you. Okay?
Nobody is there to help you at that moment.
Okay,
so you're
right.
Turned loose.
All right. I'm going to turn it on you.
Oh, try.
Okay. So there's no access or there's no connection to the people like Michael. Okay.
You don't know who they are, how to find them.
So hold on a second. Other than Googling today,
but you're sick, you're scared.
So how would you want to be told or find out? Because Michael's point is you need to take personal accountability to find out.
No, somebody's got to transition you and say, this stuff is available. And
Who is that person? Who's that person?
The doctor.
The physician should do it.
And they don't. They shy away from this.
And they
run from it.
So when that isn't working... Right. Who should be? Who should we be going after to be that conduit of information?
Reach us now, then, so we'll know.
Can't be
the
discharge managers or any caseworkers.
Let's say if you have private insurance and you're in a medical group, a case manager is going to bring this topic up. They're going to do what they can to go down this path. There's some organizations. I'm not going to mention names, but there's a national organization that actually will address these issues with patients and families who they have been identified by the primary care physician. Mm. It ultimately is the primary care physician's responsibility to do a handoff to somebody.
Right. But they don't. They don't.
I agree with you, Paul.
So let me just take us back for a minute, all right? Is this a symptom of modern life that we have a lack of this? Was this something that happened more organically in smaller communities, in places of that we're not so disconnected from one another?
Did you pick up on some of this stuff earlier in life? Michael can answer this.
Or has this always been like this?
Michael said it when he was in Western Pennsylvania, that death was a part of living. Today we've taken the word out. We don't even have funerals. I was going to ask him about his facility. He does beginning and ends. Yeah. I'll bet he doesn't have funerals in the house.
We don't have funerals, but we have had a number of celebrations of life.
But when I was a kid, or when my father was a kid.
I'd like to do celebration of death.
The funerals were held
at the
house.
You're just morbid. That's what
I am.
My father, when his mother died, when he was a little boy in the 20s, they had the funeral at the house, partly out
Correct.
Of expense, but that
in
was
in the parlor.
In the parlor, and you took it out, and the casket was left in the house open for days.
Right, and you slept in the house.
You
with
slept
that
in the house with the dead person
body there.
But that was because you were Irish and you had to wait.
No.
That was part of the process. You were expected to be.
So it wasn't hidden and shielded.
We're shielded from this. Right. Do you know, in today's world, you die in the hospital on the unit. People don't even see the body go off the unit. Mm-mm. I'm not going to say exactly what happens. But they basically hide it, and they'll close all the doors, and they'll do all the things. So we don't see death
ever.
Exactly.
And so when somebody dies, it's not just limited to human beings, by the way, right?
What you guys are talking about is making me think of stuff like that. We just dispose of. Okay, flowers die. They used to dry them. Now they just get thrown out. Things are disposable the minute they stop being of value.
You know
right?
what it's really like? This image just came to me. Have you ever been to Disneyland? You never see them take the trash out?
Yeah.
Because they have underground tunnels that just remove it all? That's the way it is in the hospital and all these things. People are removed secretly, quietly.
The other piece that he doesn't mention is that there's always something new that's coming down the pike. Uh-huh. We've got drugs and different types of things that are offering rescue opportunities for patients who are dying. There's a couple of drugs that right now that are being sold to direct-to-consumer stuff that's being sold to people who literally have 6 months or less to live, and it says we can give you 3 more months of life. We can give you this amount of more time. And they're saying we're not going to cure you. We're going to just give you a little bit more time.
A little booster.
And I'm all for improving the length of life if it's quality.
Right, but if those three months are not quality, then.
And that's hopefully what we're doing, but I don't know. These are very expensive drugs, by the way.
So you're dealing with a subject that's been completely removed from society. People don't die anymore. If they do, they die away from everybody else, hidden. The body is removed quickly. Nobody even views the body anymore because we don't have funerals anymore. Another big thing I'm just aghast at. We all just have a celebration where we gather and say, poor old Rod was a great guy. But nobody ever looks at the body. Nobody has to face the fact that he died.
Yeah.
We don't go to the gravesite and lower the casket in that makes you grieve. All these things we used to do that we think are hideous and grotesque and awful now. So death has just been totally removed from our consciousness.
Well, what is the likelihood that that's not going to continue to be the case in our society? I mean, you could argue the baby boomers don't want to talk about it or hear it.
Right.
It's high. Nobody wants to talk about it or hear it.
So what are we doing here talking about it?
Turning off people, obviously. Nobody wants to hear this.
Yeah.
So what do we do, Michael? I mean, are we just going to have these every 2 years? We're going to have a frustrated group of people.
Oh, I'm not frustrated.
Kind of thing?
I'm not frustrated.
Okay,
I am not frustrated. I am very hopeful. I'm very hopeful because every time I do this, every time I do this, I educate a whole family. I educate a whole family. And every one of us that's doing this work out there is educating an entire family each time we meet with a patient. We're educating a family. Mm-hmm. We're educating our community. We're becoming stronger and dealing with people who don't want to deal with this. You know, I have actually said to physicians, I will see more death than you ever will.
Hmm. Yeah, they never see it.
They don't see it. Mm-hmm. They get the phone call. Mm-hmm. I'm at the bedside. I know what it looks like. I know what it looks like.
Let me give you another weird thing.
Yeah.
When you die, my dad died. He had three physicians he'd known for years, had a close relationship with all of them, he thought. Not one of them was there. Not one of them even came to the hospital to see him. And not one of them, after he died, called me up to say, I'm so sorry, your dad was a great guy. They never called ever again. He just disappeared off their patient records. Somebody they had seen for years that he thought he was friends with. Mm-hmm. That's how much they run from the topic of death, because I don't want to get sued. Maybe I had something to do with it. Maybe I said something.
But I think it's also against the basic programming. I mean, if you're in extension of life and doing everything to sustain it,
when it comes to that moment,
your DNA wiring is not.
You know, I want to share with you something that I do to this day. I consider myself kind of like the waiter at the end of the meal, okay? The waiter at the end of the meal brings the dessert tray to the table. Doesn't say you can have all of it. You can pick one. Mm-hmm. Here is what we have available to you on this tray. Mm-hmm. Some of it you may have to pay extra for. Some of it's free. Mm-hmm. These are choices that you can make. And we're going to have a conversation about everything on this tray because that's my job. Mm-hmm. And my job is to tell you the good stuff and the less good stuff. Mm-hmm.
What a great analogy. What a great way.
So
to
while other people bring you the bill, Michael brings you the
goodies. He brings you the goodies.
I think that having control over this aspect of your life, the last chapter, allows you to orchestrate your death.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think that the kind of the ironic nature of this conversation, in a way, is that we live in a society that encourages you every step of the way to take independent control and have, you know, decision making, and, you know, it's the point of preventive this and, you know,
plan for this,
and sells you on that concept of it. You are in control if you engage every step of the way. And then it gets to this and nobody wants to touch it.
Right. But I'm going to go back to one thing, because I want to make sure this is recorded for posterity, is that within 5 years, there will be a place called home that we will do exactly that. I believe that will happen.
So do you know what you'd ask if you went in there?
Like in the movie, you can go.
There's a piece of music that I would want played.
Certain scenes.
Nessun Dorma.
Uh-huh. Yes.
Pavarotti.
Nice choice.
Nessun Dorma. And I would want pastoral scenes, waves of grain, flowers, things like that, hummingbirds, whales jumping, things of that nature.
I want Inagata DeVita played. That's one.
I told you it was more.
And I believe that will happen because what we're going to find out is that it's not working the way that it was intended.
So will the rest of the movie come true? And then after you die, they'll turn you into dog food?
No.
The rest of the
I will tell you something though. A year ago or 2 years ago, there was somebody that came up with a pod that was basically you become
the
tree.
That's
a burial, and they bury you, and you become a tree. You become the food
for the tree. Yes.
That's kind of cool.
But of course, it appeals to him. He's a baby boomer. Well, you know.
That's kind of cool. Right. So let me give you another case example. So because I don't think we're doing enough of these graphic explanations to get it. So my friend...
what did you have for breakfast this morning?
My friend John was my childhood buddy. He died a year ago. And a couple of years ago, he had a couple of massive heart attacks. We thought he was going to die then. But he came back and ever since then lived a half life. You know, he couldn't function, had 30% heart, whatever you call it.
Ejection fraction.
Yes, there you go. That's what they call it. But young in there, and everybody, hooray, John's made it. He's alive. He's still going. And everybody's hopeful he's going to get better and get on the horse again and start life again. We're the same age. He's 60. So I didn't see him the last year of his life. He always made an excuse, and I made an excuse because I knew he was getting worse, and he knew he was getting worse. And I didn't want to see him that way, and he didn't want me to see him that way. And finally, uncharacteristically, he went in and out of the hospital many times. I never knew about it till afterwards. And I said, why didn't you call me? I would have come to, oh, no, I didn't want to bother. Just another, you know, going in for another this or that. But I'm fine. Everything's good. Hopeful, hopeful, hopeful. Positive, positive. Finally, I get the call. And his wife says, he wants to see you. Ooh, this can't be good, right? So I go racing down. He's in the hospital again. And he looks horrible. He looks like my dad did. He looks like he's 90. He can barely move. He can barely function. He's dropping in and out of being awake and everything here. And I think, this is horrible. And I get on the phone with his wife, and I'm like, why didn't somebody tell me this? And she's like, well, why didn't you ask? You know. And but she's in denial. She says, well, it's not like he's dying. And I said, oh, okay. So I go out and have this long conversation with him into the night, and we talk. And he didn't really want to talk about dying. He wanted to talk about the old days, and he wanted to talk about what's coming up and new things. Everything but dying. We never talked about the subject. His last conversation with him, we never talked about him dying. He knew he was dying. I knew he was dying. And 2 days later, he died. And I think to myself, and so much of that conversation was his misery, his worry. What's going to happen to my wife? What's going to happen to my family? What's going to happen to me? You know, what do you think? The things we should have talked about. What comes next? Are you ready? You know, what do you want to talk about? What do you want to clear the air with? None of that happened. We had this roundabout conversation, and he died. And I felt so terrible. I felt like I wanted to have one more conversation with him where we got real, because we'd always gotten real the rest of our life.
Okay, so having said that,
yeah,
if you were in that situation again,
right,
would you do it any differently?
No, because it was his choice. I couldn't force him to face or talk about things he didn't want to talk about. But to Michael's point, a year ago, 2 years ago, 3 years ago, he could have started having palliative care discussions, people forcing him to deal with what he didn't want to face, people, his family, to deal with what he didn't want to face.
We know what the trajectory is. Yeah. We know what's going to happen.
She was in denial. He was in denial. Nobody wanted to hear about it. And in the end, he was scared. Yeah. He was scared. Yeah. And there was nobody there. The doctor wasn't there.
It was too late to have those conversations. Because these are very heavy conversations.
Yeah.
We get to do this for an hour plus and then basically turn it off until next week and we talk about something else. But there's a thing about having these conversations in incremental bites.
Yes. Yes.
Right? Because then you're having the conversations. So, Michael, I know we're almost done and I have one more thing, one order of business to do before, but how do people get hold of you?
How do people get a hold of
me? It's a secret. You can't.
They can call me.
Okay.
I'm on the Aging Life Care Professional website.
Aging
Life Care Association website.
Okay.
But I respond to phone calls, 949-355-6000.
And is there a cost to you coming out and assisting people? And how does it work?
If I'm being hired privately, there is a cost associated with that. And I charge an hourly rate, and mm-hmm. I usually ask for at least a 2-hour minimum, just so that I can help people kind of get a plan.
Mm-hmm.
I don't usually need to go out a second time unless they want me to help them implement the plan. Mm-hmm. But I will give them some direction after mm-hmm. one visit. And that's really to meet with the family. It's a I call them family interventions.
Right. And if somebody's basically finding themselves where a loved one is in the hospital or what have you, or themselves maybe, and they're feeling frustrated and feeling like hopeless and helpless and not really knowing what may be out there, it may be worth having just that connection and conversation just to feel like, if you know, somebody almost call it a second opinion. If there's something else that you should be knowing at that point. So it's rather than be frustrated and sort of suffering in silence, if you will,
right,
pick up the phone or reach out to Michael or somebody like Michael or even ask at the hospital. You know, you're entitled to certain counseling.
I wish I would have known that there's something like that existed, because in my previous example of my dad dying, your dad, right? I'm an only child, only son. You know, my dad was a big, tough guy who always, I could never quite live up to whatever, you know, I could never quite, even though he's proud of me, he never said, attaboy. You know, it was always just and so many of my friends of that generation, just to get your dad. So if there was anything I wanted to get right, was his death. I didn't want to screw this up. And when doctors started coming to me saying, what do you want to do? You want to do this? You want to do this? You couldn't do this? And I'm trying to say, well, what happens if we do this? He goes blind, or he dies, or this, and it was horrible. And there was nobody there to turn to. I was totally unprepared to make the choices I had to make.
You were also talking to people that, in all fairness to them, we're not the best person to talk to.
No. But why didn't
but
they
you,
say?
But you didn't know that that was the case.
Why didn't and they say, you know what, this here, I'm going to give you a source, I'll give you some references, right. Call this guy, call these people, call this people, and you can get some answers and maybe some assistance for him in that last 6 months that he was dying and awful and hideous.
And that's why we do the show, right. Honestly. I mean, right. It really is.
Don't do what I did. Suffer.
You know.
We do this show so we can tell you what not to do because yeah. Paul did it and it yeah. didn't work.
Didn't work.
Yeah, it's really it is work. So important to realize there's lots of information available. I mean, you can go online, mm-hmm. you can ask up your doctor's office. That people will talk to you about this. I mean, we're not.
But you have to take personal accountability in bringing it up.
You have to bring it up because it sometimes is not something. Think about what happens if your physician brings this up. Is that going to be a short conversation?
Yeah. Especially
hell no. That's a long conversation. Do you think that your doctor, even if they care about you, is going to bring that up in the doctor's appointment?
When no.
Five people are waiting in line.
Absolutely not.
No.
Oh,
it ain't going to happen.
No. Right. No. Yeah.
And let me give you another thing that you should focus on that I didn't focus on. If you're not prepared, if you haven't talked about this before, and this is your first time suddenly trying to deal with this crisis, you're doing it at the worst possible time to make judgments. My dad just fell. I have to run out there, go into the emergency room, and the doctor says his head is swelling. He's in a coma. We can operate, but there's a 50% chance he'll die, and you will be the one killing
now,
him.
Now, make the choice.
Now, make the choice. Or if he does come out, he'll probably be blind. So do you want him dead or blind? And we got no in 2 minutes.
Right, yeah.
That is why it's so important, just at the beginning of this conversation, we should really be completing an advanced directive right. that outlines how right. you want to be cared for if you can't speak for yourself.
Right.
Anybody can do that.
Now, we had done that. So.
And people avoid that like crazy.
Oh, they right. avoid that topic.
Because that makes it really real, right?
Right.
Exactly.
I'm preparing
yeah.
now.
But
yeah.
I wish some – and I'm looking everybody. I'm looking at the nurses. I'm looking
so,
at
Paul,
the doctor.
So, Paul, do you have one of those directives?
No, I'm not going to die. I'm not going to go through any of this nonsense. This is crazy talk. I'm Peter Pan. I'm going to live forever here. You all are going to go through this.
You understand
stuff.
Now
not
why
me.
I say he's the poster child for the baby boomer generation,
yes.
right?
Yes.
There.
No.
I
absolutely.
Went through it. I'm never going to go through this again. This yeah. is horrible.
So, Michael, go ahead and give your number again, if you don't mind.
My phone number, I haven't changed this number in a dozen years or 15 years or so, actually. It's 949-355-6000. And I answer
he,
it.
Yeah, he does. He is truly, I mean, not just that he's a friend, he's one of the best people that I know.
Thank you.
And gives so freely. He will charge you, but he does give of himself very freely, and you
I
saw him emotionally have that reaction to the topic.
I love my work.
Yeah, I know you do. I know you do, and truly, I think you give of yourself to every one of those clients of yours, and I think every family or every person that basically receives any care from you is very, very fortunate. So please reach out to Michael and ask those questions early. It's
yes,
okay.
Please.
It may be tough to add, to face that at that point, but you know what? The earlier you do it, the less scary it is, and the more you do it, the more empowered you feel. So don't avoid these conversations. You're not doing yourself any favors. In fact, you're basically backing yourself into a corner.
Yes.
And I want to just... What are the books that you have in front of you? You have a pile of books in front of you.
I brought a couple books just because I brought my own last time, and that was,
yeah.
that was the one that
Dying
101.
Right. And that's out of print, right?
It is out of print, but right. you can still find it on Amazon,
yeah.
on
yeah.
used copies. I brought a book. It's from in the Buddhist tradition. It's a book by Thich Nhat Hanh. No Mud.
Thich Nhat who?
Thich Nhat Hanh, and it's No Mud, No Lotus.
Okay.
It is the art of transforming
mud, no
suffering.
Lotus, I see. If there's no mud, there's no lotus.
Exactly.
Right.
Before Paul rudely interrupted, what was the topic of the book?
It's the art of transforming suffering.
Okay.
And, and it's a short book. It's one I read on vacation. Another one that I
hey, what are you reading over there? The
hey,
latest
The man truly cares.
This one by Betty Farrell and Nessa Coyle, dear friends of mine. It is
the nature of suffering
and the goals of nursing, and this is probably the best book on the topic of suffering.
Okay.
And the last one is about being mortal, and Atul Gawande. Atul Gawande talks about physicians' response in this situation and how they do a good job and not do a good job. He is an amazing physician.
They do a horrible job. They do not want to deal with this.
This is not. This is. This is. Yeah. But your expectation, Paul, is that they should.
Yes.
And what I'm saying is,
hell yes, they're there to take care of you.
But would you take up with this topic if you didn't have to? I mean, I think there's a certain
if I was
reality.
A doctor, you're,
but
you
see, that's your expectations. Your expectation is that the doctor should take it
on.
But
you haven't been there when you go home with your mom, your dad, your aunt, or somebody after the doctor says goodbye. I got no answers. Don't see me anymore. They're devastated.
Yeah.
And they feel, I came to you for years for advice and health and wellness, and now you're just shrugging and saying, next.
The best thing a physician can do, the best thing a physician could do is introduce the topic and introduce the person who has the access to the information.
Hand them off.
Hand it off. There has to be a warm handoff.
Yes.
I do this all the time in the hospital. Physicians will introduce me to the family and say, this is a person who understands this very well, knows the resources in the community. I'm going to let you talk with him for a while. Mm-hmm. I'll come back into the conversation in about an hour or maybe later today, but you need to have a conversation and have as much time to talk about this. I'm not, as your physician, am not as knowledgeable about the resources in the community. He is.
Yes.
And there's one of me like me in every hospital.
And by the way, I'll share something that's been my personal experience over the last couple of years of doing this show. Okay. Don't avoid having these conversations with your friends. If you see somebody that's in your friends or in your circle of acquaintances or family members that's sort of suffering silently on something like this or dealing with something like that, step out of your comfort zone. Reach out to them. You can do it in a very nice, personable manner that is not intrusive and to see, but at least it may give them a chance to have a sense that there's somebody there that could at least, not necessarily commiserate, but they could be a bouncing board. And we all carry information. I am much more empowered after 2 years of doing this by not avoiding talking to stuff because I can't. I've got to sit here for an hour and talk about it, right? And basically share that and let people know the more informed you are, the more likely you're going to be making decisions that are quality of life driven. And the sooner you know about stuff, even if it's difficult, the more empowered you are to make those, and you'll empower the people around you. So please don't avoid having these conversations. I mean, I don't pretend for a minute that we don't deal with tough stuff over here. We started off with elder abuse, for God's sake, right? I mean, so, and thank you, Michael, for coming
because this is
a very personal share. I mean, a very intimate way of talking about this, and we don't try to sugarcoat it or commercialize it or anything like that.
We need to teach people how to speak up too.
Yeah,
we need to teach people how to speak up and how to ask for what they need.
But how do you ask for what you need if you don't know it, right? Yeah. I mean, I think
we've got to do a better job.
And informing oneself is the first step of this.
And to accept that death is a part of living.
Okay, so before we go, though, now that we've really carried a very depressing topic today, I do want to divulge that there's been somebody in the studio with us.
Uh-oh.
Yeah.
Just have to do with the May 24th thing coming out?
Yeah, oh yeah, this is about the May 24th, okay. If it was March,
it's the only reason I hung into this show. I would not have listened to the show except you set the tease at the beginning.
You have no choice but to listen to the show. Without you, we can't run the board, right? But I do want to share with everybody that I did mention it last time that we are going to have a show that happens after the Rad Life, which is running from 12 to 1, and we kind of have been squatting in the 1 to 2 o'clock
time
slot.
Get you used to sticking around.
Right? Yeah. See, you like that? I was kind of very subtle about it. I was like, Paul, you don't have anybody right here, right? So I can just
squat. So we built up your audience by talking about death and dying and everything.
Yeah. Well, you know what? It is a destination, right? And it's kind of interesting not to introduce the name of the show right now, right? But we did talk about another show that's going to be coming up after, and it's going to be Check Out California.
Which has a kind of weird connection in the show.
I'm sorry, Greg. This is not what I had in mind.
Thinking about Hotel California.
Yeah, right.
So, you check in, but you don't check out.
Right, but so Craig Sullivan here and I are going to be basically co-hosting a show called Check Out California, and it's going to be about your key to California hospitality, basically. And so, Craig, say hi.
Hi, how are you, everyone?
Not your key to hospice, but hospitality.
Which, by the way, yes, when we've talked about it last time Michael was here, about the hospitalers and the fact that this was a care. So again,
caring for the
we are continuing to care enough to bring you information. And so, Craig, tell everybody what your background is, just a little bit.
He's got to get closer to the mic. We should have set up a mic for him.
No, it's okay. It's on this.
Oh, okay.
Oh, on here. Okay, yeah. Here you go. Go ahead, come closer.
I won't bite.
Please. I've been working in the hotel business for about 25 years now. I've underwritten, closed over $22 billion with hotel sales, refinances, construction loans, nationally and internationally. I've helped clients with their franchise agreements and their development of hotel assets. We're also working on, we launched a California-focused hotel investment conference.
Last year. This year, actually.
Yeah, March 9th of this year here in Orange County. And it'll be returning next year on March 8th. And that's CLIC, the California Lodging Investment Conference. So
what crazy option did you get to want to have a radio show with me?
I just thought it'd be really a good idea to start pulling our community and the rest of the area together. We've got some really unique assets here on the hotel front. You know, from the Montage to Disneyland and everything in between. So we've got, you know, conventions, we've got, you know, leisure travel, we've got it all focused here. And it's, you know, this is over a $60 billion industry to our country. So this is a huge amount of revenue.
Mm-hmm. In particular for this county. I mean, hospitality and tourism and travel and all that stuff is lodging and everything is huge.
Absolutely. And, you know, if it wasn't for the hospitality industry, your real estate taxes on your home would be dramatically higher.
Because somebody's got to pay for all this.
Yeah. Right. And I think that's going to become more and more of an important reality as we are more and built up, more and
bed
more
taxes
built,
and
out,
all
built out,
exactly.
built out right. communities and the old economic engines of what you could do of basically just real estate development. I think that's going to change, especially, like I said, in desirable locations that are built out. With that as a tease, I'm not going to have you guys talk about that anymore. People want to hear. They're going to start showing up. We're going to do it twice a month to begin with.
But we're not going to talk about death and dying right before we check out California.
I want to talk about. I want to talk about. Greg sat here for the last about half an hour or so.
Yeah.
Okay. Because he wanted to get a sense of just the zany wackiness that happens in this room.
Exactly.
Right? And so I want you to take a minute and tell me, how was your experience?
The experience was good.
Topic was light enough for you?
Come on, be honest.
The topic really is very personal because my mother just passed away in February.
Sorry to hear that. Yeah.
I lost my father a number of years ago, went through this with him. Mm-hmm. He had some issues, and he was prepared. He actually took us all through everything and did everything. My mother, not so much. With Mother's Day just around the corner.
Yeah.
It's
And
I'm Irish at 60 as well.
Are you? There's some similarities here. Yeah.
What am I doing to myself, surrounding myself with these
people? Exactly. You know, so I'm preparing my estate and getting everything ready. I've got a grandson now who's about 11 months old.
Mm-hmm. Mine's
3 years old.
So it's like, you know, I'm telling my son all the time, you're out of the will. We're scared.
Yeah, that's right. I'm going straight to him.
Yeah, exactly.
Am I lying that of our age, this is not a topic that people want to talk about, even among friends? We commiserate of what we've gone through with our parents, and most of my friends really didn't want to hear that. They were sympathetic and supportive, but they didn't really want to hear too much of what I was dealing with my parents until they had to go through it, and then we had something to talk about. But us? I don't hear us talking about it.
Our generation really didn't. We had incredible parents that, you know, came through the Depression and a lot of other things.
World War II, the Depression, all this stuff,
You know, they were happy when they had ketchup and they could make soup and had a dirt floor and all of that. And a lot of that is true.
Right.
Tenements in New York and everything
else. My dad was dirt poor growing up and arose himself, never went to college and became an executive with Chrysler and all this stuff. And he was as prepared, I think, as he knew how to be for this moment. But
well, you guys, you've shared before, and I think it's interesting because I haven't had really this conversation with Greg before, but it sounds like in both of your cases, your dads basically kind of were the prepared person, kind of. But in your case, Paul, you were saying that even that was the case, he was looking out for your mom, and then it ended up, who passed away first?
My mom did. My dad was the caregiver for my mom. She had Parkinson's and all sorts of other
things. And yet he thought he was going to go first?
No. Everybody thought my mom would go first, including her. That's what she hoped, and she did. And then he got as prepared as he could get. But as he got older, he became more childlike. Hmm. And suddenly, he wasn't in charge anymore. I was in charge. Who elected me? I didn't want to be in charge. You know, and all of a sudden I'm in charge and I'm telling him what to do, and I'm cleaning up as he's making messes and can't get to the bathroom in time and things I was never prepared to see my dad do. Mm-hmm. And then, yeah. And now he's in a coma. Mm-hmm. I can't ask him, Dad, wake him up. What should we do, Dad? He's in a coma. No, it's your decision now. Don't mess it up.
Yeah. And being the only child.
Yeah.
There is nobody else.
There's nobody else, yeah. Right. I don't know if that's good or bad. I
got to say, I think it's really a good thing. Mm-hmm. My parents loved me. They were together till the day my dad passed.
So my parents, yeah.
My mother just passed. My father passed 23 years ago, and I look at it this way, that my mom and dad are together after a 23-year vacation away from one another, and yeah. Now she's just bending his ear, filling him in on everything.
Yeah. Right. It's a good Irish Catholic way of looking at it.
Yeah, it really is. And my dad was prepped. My mom was to a degree. But, you know, when you don't have siblings, you don't have all the battles that you see.
Yes.
Your neighbor and your cousin and his two brothers and, you know, your other cousin and his sisters. And one is always trying to be the alpha whatever, and the other two are... you know, kind of at each other's throats. So, right.
And I've seen that too. My wife's and her family and other friends and stuff who the arguments over what we're going to do.
Right.
No, Dad's ready to go. No, Dad's not ready to go. You're trying to kill Dad because you want his money and I don't want his money. And
so other than in this room,
yeah,
because you know what's fascinating? I'm sitting here watching this, right? We kind of closed that part of the show and we said we're just going to talk about this next show coming out. And I'm sitting back and I'm watching this because what it's telling me is you guys are connected. I mean, you've never met Greg
never
before.
Met. I don't know who he was.
You just walk into the room and he's like, who's this guy walking into my room, right? And you were here for about half an hour and we're talking about this, right? And yet you guys could go for another hour talking about this is what I'm gathering. And
so many of our shows are like that.
How often do you guys both get a chance to even talk about this?
Never. If I do, I avoid.
Never. You know, I didn't tell my son. I mean, he's got a wife, beautiful wife, two stepkids, and they've got a baby together. Mm-hmm. So wasn't going to unload on him. You know,
exactly.
You need to be focused. Yeah. You know, so you internalize everything. I live at the beach here, so I spend a lot of time there. You know, especially when things are a little sad. But we could go on for far more than an hour.
You've seen this
in the past. Yeah, I always apologize at a speaking engagement because I'm Irish and I'm incapable of telling a short story.
Oh, I love this guy already.
You know,
I love this guy already.
It's not in our DNA. It is in our clan thing. It is. I don't know if you've been back to Ireland.
Yes, so you know what the proof of that is? One time, my parents took me. We went to, I was in college, and my dad said, we're all going to go back and see the old sod one time. Yeah. Heard about it, you know, but... Yeah. And so we got back there, and the two things I always say the takeaway was, one, everybody looked like me. I'd never been someplace where everybody looked like me or my cousin. That was weird. And two, how quickly I fell into some of these things and how much I understood some of the background and where it came from. I'm Irish, so I'm either way up or way down, and that's the way they are. The weather's either really beautiful or it's awful and miserable and cloudy. Yeah. All these things I saw, but the one proof of your statement was you can't ask a simple question on the street.
No.
I'm in Dublin. And we want to know where O'Connell Street, a very famous street there. And I stopped somebody, where's O'Connell Street? Oh, O'Connell Street, when me father first met me mother. Ah, God bless his soul. But the rat scully died, leaving me not a penny to his soul, he did. And if only my mother had known, she would have married that other rat down the street, and I wouldn't be there. And they're going on and on and on, and I'm like, I just want to know where O'Connell Street is.
Well, and the other thing is, when you're in a pub,
right?
The other thing is, when you're in a pub, especially in Dublin, and it doesn't necessarily have to be in the Temple Bar area, as soon as you talk, somebody look at you and go, you're a Yank. And you go, yes, I am. And it's like instant rock star. You never pay for a drink.
Yes, oh, exactly.
Taking you to parties.
Yeah,
you know,
that's true, too.
It's incredible. It's a land of incredibly
even more crazy, right? Because you would say that culturally or DNA, whatever you want to call it, right, you guys are pre-wired to have these long, dragged out conversations,
particularly
about
morbid
stuff in life,
subjects.
Right? No, but you don't.
No.
And that's my point, is even in that case where you have it in you to have long conversations and discussions, first of all, we as a society, we've said this a million times, do not sit at the friggin' table and have conversations that don't have an agenda or to-do list anymore.
The Irish are filled with doom and gloom stories and old morbid tales.
Doom and gloom stories, but you guys don't even talk about this.
No.
But also, and there's a very good book out there called How the Irish Saved Society.
Really? Oh, I have to see that.
And this goes back to the Roman Empire.
Do I really want to do this? two of these guys in one room for another hour? Oh, God.
So
the first hour, which is the Rad Life, we jokingly say is Paul's therapy session.
Right.
With you two in the room, it looks like the second hour of Check Out California is going to be my therapy session. And Michael's nodding his head. Yeah,
I love it.
Sorry, Greg, you're safe.
So anyhow, this book goes back to the Roman Empire and how the Irish were taken as the scribes for the world. Mm-hmm. They wrote down everything.
They did.
So,
especially because a lot of them were monks and all that. Yeah. When the Dark Ages came upon Europe and so much knowledge was lost, it was kept alive in the monasteries of Ireland.
Exactly.
Partly because they were so remote. Yeah.
Exactly.
I think leaving you with that note.
Bye.
We will see you on the 24th, Greg and
I. What we should say is Cade Mail Falte, if I pronounce that right, which is 100,000 welcomes.
100,000 welcomes. So 100,000 welcomes starting on May 24th.
Looking forward to it.
Check out California.
Thank you.
Michael, thank you for being here. Appreciate it. Paul, as always, I don't know if it's a pleasure or not, but it's something.
It's pain and pleasure.
And thanks, thanks everybody for being on the Rad Life today. I know it was kind of a little bit of Blair Witch Project feed on Facebook, but hey, you know what? We keep it interesting.
Keep it real.
Even when the topic is heavy. So we'll see you guys next week again, Wednesday, 12 to 1 on octalkradio.net, the Rad Life, and on the 24th. Is that next week? No, 2 weeks.
2 weeks.
2 weeks. We will be coming to you also with the Check Out California, Greg and I.
So check it out.
So come check us out.
You have been listening to the Rad Life Radio Show with your host and age explorer, Rad Gontos, brought to you on the one and only octalkradio.net. Join us again next week as we continue our journey of discovery into life's challenges, opportunities, options, and all the latest and greatest things that come with getting older.